Okay, round two. Name something that's not boring.
A laundry? Ooh, a book club. Computer solitaire, huh?
Ah, oh, sorry, we were looking for Chumba Casino.
That's right, ChumbaCasino.com has over 100 casino-style games. Join today and play for free for your chance to redeem some serious prizes. ChumbaCasino.com. No purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. 18 plus terms and conditions apply. See website for details.
The effort to remove Mr. Berman is part of a clear and dangerous pattern of conduct that began when Mr. Barr took office and continues to this day. Mr. Barr's actions make clear that in his Department of Justice, the president's allies get special treatment. The president's enemies, real and imagined, are targeted for extra scrutiny. And the needs of the American people and the needs of justice are generally ignored.
One of the greatest dangers to democracy is that people start believing that prosecutions are based on politics or based on who the defendant happens to know. And unfortunately, Bill Barr has perverted the Department of Justice.
Jay Clayton should withdraw his name from consideration and refuse to be an accomplice to this scheme.
Hello and welcome to TrumpCast. I'm Virginia Heffernan. Ooh, boy, it's been another week of tesseracts and quark holes and worm rays into red dwarves of reversed polarities wrapped in an enigma. Basically, it just sucks. Every state, except New York, it seems, did not bring the hammer down hard enough on the deadly pandemic that is now America's constant companion. And cases of coronavirus are steeply on the rise across the country. At the same time, the police, after their slight setback and moment of reflection, are licking their chops talking about lynching as if it's, I was going to say the 1920s, but actually as if it's just what it is. 2020, when we have a world of Thorazine-deprived QAnon believers who belong in paper slippers and believe Trump is their savior, here to crush Black Lives Matter and Bill Gates and, of course, the great Satan. I'm with Jeff Charlotte that the 2020 race is very different from the 2016 one. This year, the Trumpite ralliers, what's left of them, aren't talking about the wall. They aren't even talking about the things that used to warm the cockles of their hearts, like the mass deportation of Muslims and Mexicans. You don't even hear from them, the grab bag of right-wing shibboleths about infrastructure, healthcare, taxes they used to drone on about. They don't care about any of that. Not even the wall. The dregs of the Trumpites, the ones who've created ever more circumlocutious rationalizations for his corruption, lawlessness, ineffectiveness, idiocy, and cruelty, they're talking without apology about child molesters and satanic influencers. That's right. In some ways, it's good to have actual Satan back in the Trump picture, because I can sometimes follow all this QAnon stuff better with that shorthand. Just Satan. When JFK Jr. back from the dead and something about Bill Gates and the vaccine isn't part of it. It's just Satan. Just Satan. Anyway, if you're having a harder time even than usual talking to the stout-hearted Trumpites in your midst, the ones who won't give him up for nothing, it's probably because they've gone full flat earther and are speaking in tongues. But there are some people in our world who have to tune all this out and remind us there's still a U.S. Constitution and a rule of law, however bullet-riddled, and that it's possible to keep your head clear. Today, my guest is just that person. Jed Sugarman, star of stage and screen, professor at Fordham Law School. He's the author of The People's Courts and forthcoming Rise of Prosecutor Politicians and The Imaginary Unitary Executive. Jed's going to put in perspective the recent earthquakes at the D.C. Circuit Court and the Southern District of New York, along with Bigfoot Bill Barr and the plight of former federal prosecutor Jeffrey Berman. Welcome to TrumpCast, Jed.
Thanks for having me back, Virginia. Great to talk to you.
This is the first time you've been back on the show since the troubles, the new troubles, the extra bonus troubles. And it's really good to even behold you on Zoom. So let's talk. I don't know if you've ever noticed this, but my background picture on Twitter is a tabloid headline from The Crown, you know, the Queen Elizabeth story. And she's on a train in the beginning and some things are going wrong with the English royal family. And the headline is, what the hell is going on with this country? And I remember at the time on the show, I thought a lot of things were going wrong, in the 50s when she read that. And I now can't even remember what was going on in London in the 50s on the show because I'm so overwhelmed by events of our own time. So anyway, what the hell is going on in our country? Chapter 5 million, Michael Flynn. Tell us about Flynn.
Yeah, I mean, first of all, you're totally right about how we're living in a time of time relativity. I mean, it's like Einstein right now. Like, it feels like, what is today, March 110th or something? I mean, it's...
yes.
And it feels like it has been both a day and 10 years since the Ukraine impeachment, right? Literally, I think it is actually about, we're in the exact equal point between the Senate trial and an election day.
You would keep track of something like that. I mean, the impeachment seems to be, as they say, of the microbes in this virus, aerosolized right now, in the sense that it's the cloud, it's sort of the air we're still breathing when it comes to, say, Michael Flynn. So as I always think about it, this whole thing, or the Russia investigation component of things that rolled into the Ukraine investigation, began with those fateful words, memorialized by James Comey, "I hope you can see your ways clear to letting Flynn go."
And that was the very beginning, and it all comes back full circle.
Yep.
And where we're heading to now is the end game, and perhaps talking about the pardon power, because, the way things are shaking out with Flynn, just to jump to that point, I think the big picture point with Flynn is, one, Barr has, to the extent that people think that Barr is an evil genius, they're half right. Mm-hmm. that William Barr certainly has, to the extent that people thought that this was the rule of law guy, he seems to neither have an understanding of rule or law. And the way this is shaking out, both will, we can talk both about the Flynn and the Southern District, but boy, Barr really tried to be, Trump thought he had a fixer. It turns out, I think Roy Cohn is a lot better of a lawyer than William Barr because...
Yeah, tell me.
Right? Well, the idea that they would be able to drop these charges on Flynn and game this out about the litigation, Barr has misread a number of things here, but he misread what would happen if there was pushback on dropping the charges, because with this little time left, if I just taking a step back of the merits of what Judge Sullivan, the federal trial judge, would be doing, and what the D.C. Circuit did yesterday, on Wednesday with Flynn's charges, either way, there was going to be enough to litigate that the clock would run out on Barr being able to intervene in on behalf of Trump. And that still is going to leave Trump at some point deciding whether he has to pardon people like Flynn and Stone after hopefully losing, right? But perhaps winning, right? There's still, this is not going to get Trump off the hook. I mean, I guess if Trump wins, then there's time to fully litigate this. But if Trump loses and a Biden administration is coming in, just to walk through the litigation timeline, first of all, this was a three-judge panel. I mean, just to be clear to non-lawyers out there, what happens next is, regardless of the merits, this was an extraordinary intervention by this three-judge panel, a 2-1 decision.
Actually, can you back up and even explain to us, like, who is Michael Flynn? And then go to here. Yeah.
Right. I mean, so the background is, right, first Flynn pleads guilty to lying to the FBI. And then after there is some effort to create new facts on the ground and create questions about the motives of the prosecution and to engineer these questions, right, they selectively release some documents and the Barr DOJ basically cherry picks and reframes in ways that are dramatically unfair and sort of, to undermine the DOJ itself and undermine the FBI. And it's so remarkable, first of all, Virginia, that we have an attorney general who's made it his job to delegitimize the Department of Justice and the FBI, and to basically weaponize and cherry pick documents to make these institutions that usually the attorney general struggles to make sure that they are seen as fair. He has weaponized and taken out of context a series of documents to systematically undermine the legitimacy of law enforcement in America.
We just had Mattathias Schwartz on the show, and he was talking about Barr's CIA time. And sometimes I think Barr, he's like the ultimate globalist. Like, I'm not sure that he, in the sense that he's like, he answers only to the Vatican or to the pope that he likes who's locked under the floorboards or whatever his crazy Opus Dei superstitions are, right. And that he has his mind more on international matters as Flynn does. And for that reason, the FBI is somehow beneath him.
I think that's actually too generous.
Ah, okay.
Because I don't think that Barr is concerned with worldly or world historical judgment. I think he has his eye towards his own warped version of heavenly judgment. And I don't mean to be cavalier, or I don't mean to be engaging in hyperbole. I'm just reading Barr's speeches.
No, I know. I've
written for Slate, and I think about this. I've written about two of his speeches, one to Notre Dame, quite specifically to Notre Dame on culture wars, and talking about that he is in service of more heavenly virtues. And there is and I'm using the word crusade in the appropriate context of being of crusade. He is a crusader. And then he also gave a jaw-dropping speech to the Federalist Society, mapping out a totally warped ahistorical explanation for the imperial presidency.
I also have had questions about his intelligence, and there's a certain self-presentation in a Barr type that has everyone sort of black box the idea that he's got to be intelligent. He's signaling intelligence, that he's got that slouchy face and he always falls back into himself. Like, he's just so confident. He has it all worked out. And he says, if you just read it, the things that he says slide off the rails all the time. But there's some way, and people used to say this about Dick Cheney, that he just has all kinds of things that code as kind of an Oxford Don to Americans.
That's exactly right. You know? Part of it is that he grew up in a cultural milieu of, being at elite private schools in New York City as the kid of the headmaster.
Yes, Dalton, where his father hired Jeffrey Epstein famously. Yes.
Right. I mean, but there is his self-presentation is so utterly confident that one would look at him and think, this is a self-possessed veteran of the Department of Justice who has been through so many of these controversies and has navigated through them. And if we might, even if we think that Iran-Contra and Panama and all of these gigantic scandals of the 1980s and 1990s, he just happened to be in the middle of them. But that experience and his self-presentation come across as Mr. Rule of Law.
Yeah.
And just watching these series of events shows that he's actually not a good lawyer.
Okay, this is so interesting, because one of the sub themes of TrumpCast has been how a mob, how a mafia needs to have kind of window dressers or whitewashers like Hope Hicks and Ivanka Trump. But it also needs a kind of, you're making it clear, someone like Trump needs a kind of sage figure who's like in the Rasputin slot or the whatever, maybe Dick Cheney slot, so that everyone else can seem like a flake. But that person seems like they're sort of, they have some book learning.
Yes.
And you, it was pretty brave of you to start pointing out, he's really, he lacks the fundamentals to work as the kind of jurist that he wants to be seen as.
Yeah.
All right. So let's get to Flynn, because he's such a great case study in what is Barr's strange motivations and strange tactics at the same time.
Yeah.
So, okay. We know who Michael Flynn is. We know that he seems to have gone around Obama in the transition. And it was right around Christmas, right?
It was precisely in the transition. That's exactly right. It was right. It was the very end of December. I think it was December 28th, the 27th, 28th, where Flynn is. We now know that he was on the phone with Kislyak and they were navigating, or maybe Kislyak and Lavrov, and to negotiate a stand down when the Obama administration imposed sanctions post-election.
Yeah,
Flynn, we've seen a little bit of the transcript, and it's is it a transcript or is it a summary? But that there was contact between Flynn and Russia. Some people will invoke something called the Logan Act as the criminalization of doing foreign policy when you're not yet in the administration. Mm-hmm. Let's set that aside. The Logan Act is something that could be a distraction. There hasn't been a Logan Act prosecution, but. In 200 years. But the point is that Flynn felt like he had to hide something. So he told the FBI that he had not spoken to the Russians, and that he had not mentioned sanctions and this policy when he spoke to the Russians. And they had a transcript, and it was clear that Flynn had lied. And so ultimately, as things played out, Flynn then, as the Mueller team turns the screws and shows Flynn that there are other indictments that could be possible. Specifically, we know that there is a FARA, the foreign lobbying criminalization. You have to be able to indicate that you are lobbying for a foreign power. Flynn could have been indicted on FARA violations. And there are other questions about Flynn and his son and their criminal liability for a conspiracy to do something with a Turkish cleric, that there may be more details there we don't know about. But for whatever reason, to minimize the criminal indictments that Flynn and his son may have faced, Flynn pleaded guilty to lying to the FBI. Mm-hmm. Okay. And then flash forward all the way to this past winter and spring, and then in a combination of selectively releasing information about that investigation and ginning up, manufacturing the idea that there was something untoward about indicating that they would drop the investigation, but then not filing papers to drop it, and then asking Flynn questions. Somehow that process becomes, in Barr's framing, illegitimate. There's really nothing. It's just that does not delegitimize the ability for the FBI to then ask questions, and you still have to tell them the truth. Yeah. So what was Flynn hiding? Why was he hiding it? So that then leads up to the DOJ essentially conspiring with Flynn to then drop these charges and for Flynn to withdraw his guilty plea. That move, what I'm saying here is, let me identify why this is bad lawyering. I think what Barr was doing was intervening for the DOJ on behalf of Trump to save Trump the political costs of a pardon, to just drop the charges and then make sure to keep Flynn happy and try and do damage control so that Flynn wouldn't, given that he was heading towards sentencing, the Trump administration would want to make sure that he was off the hook and felt no pressure to cooperate.
And also, it's the beginning of the Russia investigation, one of the beginnings. And so in Barr's infinite devotion to discrediting the Russia investigation and solidifying his breakup with Robert Mueller and with the rule of law, he may be eager to say, and look, from the very beginning, the FBI was out to get poor General Flynn.
That's it. That's right.
Yeah. And then also, if he wants a unitary executive, he's got a vested interest in getting Trump reelected. So if it can help him politically, that's a bonus.
That's right. That's right. So it was to delegitimize the Russia investigation. Yes. Although query, how much does, pulling these moves on behalf of Flynn, it delegitimizes it to people who are already, the always Trumper base,
Yes.
I don't know for who is going to vote. Yeah. On the idea that, the DOJ dropped charges against Flynn. So yes, this now convinces me that that Trump wasn't misusing government power to protect his own people. It was only validates. I mean, really, it's sort of the lenses we have.
Right.
But no moderate voter, no independent is going to change. So, but the key thing was that this is what I'm saying about why I think Barr showed that he is not a very astute lawyer. It is clear that that Judge Sullivan still, once Flynn pleaded guilty, that shifted the playing field from this being in the hands of prosecutors entirely to then being in the hands of the court. And we can go into the weeds. I don't think it's worthwhile going into all of the legal details about whether a guilty plea means that a court has a tremendous amount of discretion to sentence regardless of what prosecutors do, or whether a judge has to defer to prosecutors. But either way, there's going to be a foreseeable litigation process where a judge like Sullivan, who's already shown the world that he finds what Flynn has done, I think Sullivan at some point even invoked the word treason, which was about Flynn, which was, first of all, incorrect legally. You can't accuse Flynn of treason for lots of reasons. But if you're reading tea leaves as a lawyer, you have to see that Sullivan is certainly not sympathetic to Flynn or to moves to try and protect Flynn. So it was both a misreading of criminal procedure, a misreading of jurisdiction, and a misreading of the room to think that he could walk in. And so in some ways, what was Barr just wanting to flex his muscles with bluster? I think on some level, I think he just made a giant legal mistake, and it's just a double whammy. What they're now facing. So let me, Virginia, explain why I don't think the merits even need to be played out, because the next step is, and this is another way that Barr misread the room. This panel was two Republican appointees and one Democratic appointee. Of the two Republican appointees, one was perceived as a sort of rule of law conservative, not a moderate, but a George H.W. Bush appointee that many people had respect for. I choose that word had carefully, because the opinion that and Judge Rao was a Trump appointee, who many people had regarded as, you know, very smart and someone who also had a lot of ambition to be a potential Supreme Court appointment. This opinion is so outrageous that I think it indicates that not only, you know, everything Trump touches dies, isn't that? Rick Wilson's book. I mean, the D.C. Circuit conservatives are shredding and scorching their own credibility here. It's hard to look at Henderson the same way now that she signed on to Judge Rao's opinion. But the point is, I mean, because it was so extraordinary to reach out on mandamus, the illegal writ term.
Yeah, what is that? I see it only in your Twitter feed. First time I've ever seen the word mandamus.
So if I can put this simply, I mean, the basic idea is that Sullivan could be overreaching, but the bottom line is you have to let the district court go through its process, and then the remedy is Sullivan can make his ruling, and then you appeal to the D.C. Circuit. Mm-hmm. And instead, because I think at some point Barr realized that the timeline was shot, they then, Barr and Flynn also, you know, wanted to rush past what Sullivan was doing, which was taking a hard look at this prosecution move. Mm-hmm. And they instead of waiting to appeal a decision by Sullivan, they circumvented Sullivan after he appointed an amicus to help him investigate former mm-hmm. Judge Gleason.
Yeah, that's right.
Gleason then filed this report. Now, this is another topic, but this is actually an embarrassment on both sides. Former Judge Gleason's report, I thought, was an embarrassment as well, because I think everyone's wearing these partisan blinders these days. Mm-hmm. And Judge Gleason wound up writing a report that suggested that withdrawing a guilty plea can be used as a perjury charge. That if you plead guilty and then you decide and then you change your mind on your guilty plea, then either you were lying then or you're lying now.
Right. It amounts to the same thing.
I'm oversimplifying this, but let me just say that there is an enormous legal problem and a moral problem, I think, for saying that anytime a person withdraws a guilty plea, it then puts them at jeopardy of a perjury claim just for withdrawing the guilty plea, because it means that there's an inconsistency in what they said to the court. There are all kinds of reasons to withdraw a guilty plea. That you want to contest, that maybe you had some question about how strong the evidence was. You come up with new evidence, you find a new witness, and suddenly your ability to say, "Well, I thought there was reasonable doubt. I thought that there was proof beyond a reasonable doubt, but now I want to actually vindicate my rights in court. I want my day in court." Mm-hmm. For Judge Gleason against Flynn to indicate that could be a perjury charge is, frankly, Virginia, outrageous by the left. Outrageous. So the Trump era is, you know, everything Trump touches dies.
Yeah.
Frankly, it's happening to some liberals too. Right? I mean, that's what's discouraging here is people on both sides are now returning to these tribal blinders and seeing the world as red and blue as opposed to right and wrong.
Yeah. Very not fine people on both sides is what I'm hearing.
I think people are so, there is such a degree of outrage on both sides that people are not thinking with their full capacity and thinking independently. And it doesn't say great things about Judge Sullivan either, that when he got Gleason's report, he had a duty, because he invited Gleason to look at perjury. And I thought, there's no way that Judge Sullivan means to look at perjury for the change in guilty plea. He might be looking at perjury for some part of the allocution. Allocution is where a defendant tells the court not just a guilty plea, but allocutes and concedes facts as part of the plea.
Got it.
How this makes sense is that Sullivan wanted to see if, when Gleason looked at the facts, that maybe Flynn lied to the court about protecting Pence. You know, there is significant conjecture, reasonable conjecture, that when Flynn lied to the FBI, he also was lying about other people's culpability. And that would be the basis of perjury. If he said something like, Pence didn't know anything about this, or I lied to Pence, but he actually told Pence, or he did Trump or Pence's bidding and talking to Russia, but lied about that, that's a perjury claim. That would be perjury.
You thought the Gleason investigation might be for Sullivan turning up something of merit or of use like
that. Yes, I thought there was a mini Mueller. I thought there was possible that what Sullivan was doing was appointing Gleason to do a little bit more digging like a Mueller might have done. So there's kind of an independent prosecutor that was through the back that, and I thought this was wicked jujitsu.
Yeah. God. Okay. I know you like coming at things aslant like I do. So yeah. I saw The Big Short again last night. My son wanted to see it. I hadn't seen it in a long time, about the 2008 crash. And you maybe remember that there's a moment in it, I had actually forgotten, but where all the kind of savants who've known that, who've shorted the market, they see the subprime crisis coming, start saying to themselves, the mortgages are all junk. There are all these defaults, but the bonds aren't falling. The bonds aren't collapsing.
Yeah, right,
you know, these
right,
kind of
right.
aggregate bonds. And one of them, the Steve Carell character, shows up at Standard and Poor's to a small office and says to someone who seems to be the person that handles all the ratings for stocks. And he says, why aren't these collapsing when you have all these defaults? Why are these still triple A's?
Yeah,
and she says, well, you know, if they come to us for the rating they want, and if they don't get the rating they want, they'll go to someone else for the rating they want. And I mean, it's just so simple, and it's just so much fraud and corruption. And for some reason, and you hear them, feel them hitting a wall, which is like reality suggests that, now to move back to the subject at hand, Flynn was involved in some very sketchy stuff with Russia and Turkey, and that he broke bad in the worst way, probably one of the worst ways, of an American high-ranked military officer. And yet, at these like penny ante levels, he still got a AAA rating from Barr. It's like the thing is not collapsing. You
know? The thing is, right.
It's like Stone, when Barr is going to AAA rate Roger Stone and Michael Flynn, who he should have been willing to cut loose and short.
I love it.
And strongly short. And when he's sticking by it, that is part of the reason, you know, that I sympathize with Sullivan. Part of the reason you're going insane is that silent scream feeling of the level of fraudulence and corruption is so high here that I almost need to... just, you know, my head's going to explode.
So I love it. The Big Short is almost like must watching.
Yes.
So 3 points about this. One is the idea that markets are being propped up. We are living at a time where Wall Street, I mean, somehow we've designed a stimulus system that has basically propped up Wall Street while we're about to see the end of small business support and what that is going to do to employment when the PPP runs out in like 6 days. I mean, so talking about The Big Short, we're all about to come up short given how and let's say Virginia, both parties messed up the stimulus package. I mean, what I followed from insiders is that they just plugged and played. They just took the template from a completely different economic circumstance, the 2008 crash, a fundamentally different economic situation, but because they had to move fast. And because they're actually not, we talk about some people who are perceived to be good lawyers and aren't, no one thinks that Congress is good at economics, right?
Yep.
But they really didn't do any, you know, they just took the old template and from a different 2008 crash and just propped up Wall Street.
And subbed out, did a search and replace for, you know, exactly. AIG and Jamie Dimon and put in the American worker, the American worker, probably put Starbucks in.
That's right. And to connect some other dots, Virginia, this comes back to the unitary executive theory.
Please.
And Bill Barr, because the Democrats totally failed to acknowledge that there was a difference between the Bush administration on good... despite its incompetence in many ways, to at least say, look, in good faith, they're going to try and use the stimulus and TARP in 2008, and then going into whoever won the election in 2009, McCain or Obama, they would at least in good faith try and manage the stimulus. Whereas what the Democrats did when they agreed to the stimulus package this time around, they were hoodwinked and self-hoodwinked to putting in no teeth in oversight. I think there was a story that came out today. I just saw the headline, but it didn't surprise me today. The New York Times says that $1.4 billion of the payments went to dead people. And that is going to be nothing compared to the fact that Secretary of the Treasury Mnuchin used the word, when the inspectors general want to see where the money has gone to businesses, and they said that there's this duty for inspectors general to see it. They trust the executive branch. And what have we seen since the stimulus package has passed? And they said the inspectors general will be our guardians of the stimulus package.
Been fired.
Shocking. Virginia, who could possibly have foreseen the fact that Trump would stonewall the inspectors general? He told us when he signed it.
Yes.
He told us when he signed the stimulus package. I regard this as an impediment on the unitary executive theory. Not that he knows what that means, but, you know. And Steve Mnuchin says that the information about where the money has gone is the proprietary property of the Treasury. With the word proprietary means, I know you know this, but just to be clear, something proprietary means someone owns the property. The idea, the chutzpah of Mnuchin to say, we own the information and you can't have it, is such a thumb in the face, at the idea of oversight. So let me come back a second to this idea that, I mean, this, Virginia, is one of the big myths of our time.
Okay.
Is the construction of the unitary executive idea. And you know, just to connect the dots here from Flynn and that case, again, just what I was saying before is, you know, the time is going to run out on litigation. Another reason why Barr is a bad lawyer is that regardless of what panel he got and winning the panel, the DC Circuit is 7-5 Democratic appointees. And there's something that the DC Circuit can do. It can call for an in-bank sua sponte. All right, let me just translate that. That just means that the DC Circuit can, regardless of which random panel got it as a panel of three, you don't need Judge Sullivan, the trial judge, to ask for an appeal. One of these DC Circuit judges on their own, meaning sua sponte means on their own, can request in bank, meaning the entire circuit, to hear it. And of those 12 judges, 7 are Democrats, and I would even say there are probably some more moderate Republicans in that mix who would not sign on to this embarrassment of Judge Rao's opinion. So all of that plays out to run out the clock, and that means that we're back to a pardon. So that was one issue. But the other thing that Barr did that was part of the unitary executive theory was removing the U.S. Attorney of the Southern District. And just in very briefly, what I would say is that Barr, you know, there's a lot to see in the timeline here that looked like panic. Mm-hmm. In that, you know, why did this happen now in a way that was so mishandled that there was the story kept changing, who they were trying to put in place instead of Berman. They even botched whether or not Berman was going to step down. What happened? So, Virginia, what we know is that Barr met with Berman in New York City on last Friday. And we don't know exactly what they talked about, but somehow Barr left with urgency, regardless of what Berman intended to do. We now know that Berman had no intention of stepping down, but Barr said he's resigned. And Berman says no. And in fact, not only am I not resigning, Our Southern District investigations, our ongoing investigations, will continue with our office. Berman sent a pretty big signal that this was not just about, you know, moving on to, you know, taking a vacation over the summer, but he put on the table that this was about investigations. And then we see a shifting set of explanations, a story that, you know, Barr had lined up the U.S. attorney from New Jersey, Carpenito, and his office to take over. And telling Carpenito, oh yeah, Barr says I'm offering you this job because Berman's stepping down already. That turned out to be false. And then we get a story about the SEC commissioner taking the job. Totally ridiculous story. Anyway, the point is, all of these explanations are, you know, laughable. I mean, they don't make any sense. And even if they did make sense, the statutes don't look like they allow Trump to appoint a crony. What was all this about? Mm-hmm. I just want to say this about this connects all the way back to Jim Comey. Yep. When Jim Comey said, you know, issued that letter on November 1st about 2016 about the Hillary Clinton emails, right? This issue about the, you know.
Oh, do I remember? Yes. We're coming up on the PTSD month. So
yes.
Just be careful because there's a lot of trigger possibilities in our listeners and me.
Totally. But what was one of the reasons why people were so shocked at what Comey had done? There was a norm against reopening investigations or announcing or indicting anyone in a window of time before an election. Here's what I'm suggesting, Virginia. I think that there either was something that the Southern District of New York was about to do. And and they knew because the Southern District knows that the window is about to close. If they don't announce an investigation or indict between now and August 1st ish, they can't do anything until after the election.
Hello, it is Ryan, and we could all use an extra bright spot in our day, couldn't we? Just to make up for things like sitting in traffic, doing the dishes, counting your steps, you know, all the mundane stuff. That is why I'm such a big fan of Chumba Casino. Chumba Casino has all your favorite social casino-style games that you can play for free anytime, anywhere with daily bonuses. That should brighten your day a little. Actually, a lot. So sign up now at chumbacasino.com. That's ChumbaCasino.com. No purchase necessary. VGW. Void where prohibited by
law. See terms and conditions. 18 plus. Hi, I'm Josh Levine. My podcast, The Queen, tells the story of Linda Taylor. She was a con artist, a kidnapper, and maybe even a murderer. She was also given the title The Welfare Queen, and her story was used by Ronald Reagan to justify slashing aid to the poor. Now, it's time to hear her real story. Over the course of 4 episodes, you'll find out what was done to Linda Taylor, what she did to others, and what was done in her name.
The great lesson of this, for me, is that people will come to their own conclusions based on what their prejudices are.
Subscribe to The Queen on Apple Podcasts or wherever you're listening right now.
So while we were talking, I don't know if you got this alert, but while we were talking, there's a story in the Washington Post. Trump's pick for Manhattan U.S. attorney, so replacing Berman, has just said he would recuse from probes of the president's associates.
Was that Carpenito or was that Clayton?
That's Clayton.
So can we just say something about Clayton? I mean, the thing, and this was our good friend Jonathan Turley was spreading this propaganda.
Oh, yeah.
Right? The idea that what tells us that this was deeply corrupt is that every explanation that the Trumpers gave for this move, each one was more nonsensical than the one before it. And the idea that the explanation they needed to find a job for Clayton in New York, like, as there are lots of jobs in New York, but that he was going to be giving, he didn't need a new job. Clayton is the chairman of this SEC, an enormously powerful and prestigious job.
Slightly weakened if The Big Short is to be trusted.
Oh, that's also true.
But yes.
That's also
but yes,
true.
It's an enormously powerful job because he cannot oversee security.
But he had 2 years. He had a lot of time left if he wanted it to stay in that job.
Mm-hmm.
And the U.S. attorney job runs out when an administration runs out. And so it doesn't make sense.
Mm-hmm.
And especially, you know, and now the backfiring is that you can't just install someone when the whole point of these statutes is to protect the U.S. attorney's offices from a president appointing his own crony into a U.S. attorney's office.
I mean, this is, you know, obviously Preet Bharara, you know how every time something happens, like during the impeachment, you know, Monica Lewinsky will post something cryptic and witty when it's in her bailiwick. And I think Preet did the same thing when these moves were made on Berman. And this just keeps happening with no explanation. We know there's Occam's razor here. We
Absolutely.
Know what they're trying to do. We know, you know, we have some idea of who's under investigation. And as you say, Berman's statement was sort of a masterpiece of two paragraphs without a transition. You know, that we're like, I didn't actually resign and, you know, I'll be staying on unless I'm fired. And then, and these investigations are ongoing. So, you know, it's just what we learned from Preet Bharara. You know, as you say, Barr is acting like a failed Roy Cohn. I mean, he got, there must have been a way for, what would Cohn have done? I mean, he probably would have kneecapped someone. I mean, there must have been a way to stymie this investigation without further sullying his reputation, making Trump look even worse.
Or to know when your intervention did enough and you may be overplaying your hand.
It's also, if they're litigating or, you know, trying to replay their unusual and suspicious victory of 2016 and worried about a Comey-like announcement of emails or whatever, something that, you know, before August or even some October surprise, they are totally ignoring the fact that Trump is losing another way. He's losing on his own terms.
That's right. I mean, just keep in mind that how much Barr did to successfully delay focus on the Mueller report.
True.
And by taking there, it was possible that things could have been rolled out a little differently had the Mueller report gone out the way that Mueller and his team intended it. And Barr, you know, what would Roy Cohn have done? Roy Cohn would have recognized how successfully he both served his boss with that and then still preserved his own credibility. And this is the difference between Roy Cohn, good lawyer, and William Barr, deranged priest or something. I mean,
yeah.
Right? I mean, I'm trying to understand exactly what Barr thinks he's doing, because but let me come back to this point about this and talking about theology and something called the unitary executive theory, because many of us, a shorthand for it, we call it the Unitarians. And so just the irony, right? The irony of Bill Barr, Opus Dei Catholic.
Right, being a Unitarian. I like it.
Being a Unitarian, right?
It's pretty much the least religious, yeah, the least esoteric, the most groovy, the
most pluralistic.
Know, barely,
you know, yes.
Believe in God.
Yes, exactly. I mean, that's a wonderful theological irony, and you and I love talking about, you know, theology together, Virginia.
Yes, we do.
So here's the thing about this history, is that when you take a step back, it's the thread that underlies all of this. It's part of why the Federalist Society has been so supportive of Trump. It's, you know, do we think that it's all about Roe v. Wade? You know, talking about religion again, it's not. It's also this theological commitment to presidential power. Mm-hmm. which is a new religion of the last 50 years. I mean, really, it's when you look around at the Republican Party politically, where did the unitary executive come from? It really starts to take off. I did an engram on Google about the phrase unitary executive and what the theory.
Yeah.
So it really stems from, with a little bit of hits here and there in the 20th century, it takes off around 1980 and the Reagan Revolution. And if you were a Republican in the 1970s and 80s, you look around and you say, look, the Democrats have held the House since the New Deal, more or less, except for like this little blip in, I think, in the 50s. And the Democrats have held the Senate and up until that time, basically. Mm-hmm. And then you look at the courts and you see how from, you know, the Warren Court and you have all these elites. And then you look at the New Deal state. And even when you have Republican presidents, it's these elite basically this is the idea of the deep state. The deep mm-hmm. state happens. The idea is that these overeducated experts and elite liberals, whether they're appointed by Democrats and Republicans, they keep coming up as New Dealers. And mm-hmm. and there's this deep state professional bureaucracy that, and the only way to break through it is by having the people, the country versus court, right? The country of the United States electing the president against the court, right? The country versus court party, to go back
and
to
the legislature. And the legislature, which you'd think would, I mean, as you say, when the noticing that it's Congress,
right.
and
that's
Senate.
Right.
Yeah.
But if you empower the president,
right.
you don't have to worry about whether the House is, you know, which mm-hmm. you know, but the notion was in the 1980s that the real danger was the deep state expertise bureaucracy mm-hmm. and the New Deal and the New Deal state, the New Deal regulatory state. And the mm-hmm. only way to break through it is to give the president more power to control, override, and fire people in the executive branch. Mm-hmm. And they had to construct a mythology out of the founding that not only does it not stick with the big picture of what we know of the founding era about being anti-monarchic. I mean, basically the vision is the founders chose one president because they wanted a more royal model. And that is so out of step with what we know of the founding era and its deep skepticism of monarchic power, even if they chose one executive. Mm-hmm. But just to say a little bit more about this, when you read, so essentially the Constitution says very little about presidential power. And it takes a lot, and because it doesn't establish, it doesn't mention the removal power, it doesn't mention firing, and it doesn't mention a lot other than the veto and pardons. And it turns out that when you actually do what the originalists tell us to do, which is to look at the convention and to look at the ratification debates, mm-hmm. like, you know, Hamilton and Madison, mm-hmm. those writings cut against their interpretation of unchecked presidential power. Mm-hmm. Again and again, they talk about the importance of that the Constitution creates limited powers, limited not just on Congress, but limited sets of powers on the president. They use language, this is research we've done on this language of faithful execution, that the president shall take care that the laws be faithfully executed. The president gives an oath to faithfully execute the office. That was legal language that the two authors, Ethan Lieb and Andrew Kent and I, found that history was meant to limit presidential power.
Tell me why, because that's also very interesting, because it goes to the word executive, but also that fidelity, that faithfulness is a position of servitude, of once again, of service of the president, and to make sure that, yeah, the make sure the will of the people or the way that that's manifest in legislation is faithfully executed. It does not sound like an authoritarian move to me.
So that's exactly right. It's small r Republican. Hmm. I mean, so one example is the oath. So the oath of faithful execution was used in English statutes for hundreds of years, but only for mid-level or high-level executive officers under the king. Mm-hmm. When you stepped into an office that was a mid-level or low-level or high-level ministerial office, you took an oath of faithful execution. The kings, Virginia, this is really interesting. The founders knew what the coronation oath was for kings. They did not borrow the coronation oath language. They borrowed it's the only oath they spelled out. But the only oath they spelled out was the president's oath. And they chose the language from mid-level executive officers who serve under the king. Why? Because in a democracy, in a republic, the people are sovereign, not the president. It's popular sovereignty. And so faithful execution means serving in good faith the people, not the people serving the president. And that is why fundamentally the unitary executive model that borrows on monarchy is anti-originalist. It is frankly ahistorical and a modernist revival of monarchy rather than being true to the founding. So, but this is the other thing, Virginia, which is interesting, is that if you're an originalist, you say, go back and read the convention and go back and read the ratification debates. All of that cuts against the unitary executive. But what do they have to turn to? They manufactured a story out of the first Congress. And it turns out I started digging into the story and
this is amazing. Your discoveries here, by the way, this is why talking to you is so satisfying because, you know, it's you're a historian and a fantastic legal mind. So I'm just taking it in.
And I love talking to you because you'll tie it together with so many other things going on in the world, like, you know, religion and The Big Short. So I would tell you, sell early on the unitary executive.
Because I'm putting in my swaps. I've got it on my phone on E-Trade.
Put a short on the unitary executive because breaking news, there was a diary that all these originalists say, go and read the original sources. There was a diary, and Virginia, I don't mean a diary that I somehow, you know, escaped the COVID-19 shutdown and I sneaked into the Library of Congress.
Yeah.
This has been a diary that was published 100 years ago. And it's none of the unitary executive scholars looked at it. And this diary by a senator basically tells us that the unitary story, that what happened is that Congress passed statutes to imply that the president has this power to remove officers as part of this unitary power, mm-hmm. because the Constitution tells us that. Like that was this big myth. A senator's diary tells us that the senators, because, you know, the Senate was closed at the time, so there was no publicized.
This is 1789, right? Is that's the year of the Constitutional Convention?
That's the first Congress.
First Congress.
So 1787, the convention tells us very little about presidential power. Certainly nothing that goes this far tells us more that there are limits on it. The debate, Madison says something like, you can't interpret presidential power to be beyond the powers we've identified. Right, he says it in Latin. He uses a Latin phrase, ex vi terminus, but don't worry about that.
Okay.
Then Hamilton and Madison in the Federalist Papers tell us the same story, that Congress has the power over things like removal. Okay, mm-hmm. The Federalist Papers are the Bible of the originalists, and they tell us the opposite of what they say. But the smoking gun is, right, they then say, well, this was all not worked out, but the first Congress, when they finally met, you know, they passed the Constitution, they elect Washington. They show up in Congress in March of 1789. They have this amazingly deep debate about presidential power, and they all agree, or they resolve this debate as saying the Constitution means presidents have this unitary power to fire people like Berman or fire people like the chairman of the Fed. Mm-hmm. And not only does the debate not say what they say it says, okay? The debate does not say this. Only one third of the members of the House line up with this theory. And just to do a little math, Virginia, one third is less than half. Okay. Okay. Yeah. But here's the diary. The diary then tells us that the senators who pushed the statute through, the statute that created presidential removal, they denied that it had this meaning. And so what happens is, if I'm just urging the lawyers who are out there who care about this, is just, you know, you can, I go into the detail in these two drafts that I have up on my SSRN page. But
we can put the link in.
I'll put the links
for,
in.
For those people who like to get Talmudic on all this.
Yes.
We'll put the link in the show notes that goes through this letter and Jed's argument.
And diary. But let me tie this together.
Yeah.
Yeah. The senator's diary says that the senators who were pushing this big bill through that was going to, you know, basically clarify this constitutional power. The senators on the floor say, no, don't think that. They denied it. They denied it because they designed the language of these statutes to be ambiguous, not to be clear, because they didn't have the votes, right? Just to quote the musical Hamilton, you don't have the votes. You don't have the votes.
Right.
They didn't have the votes. And so why does this matter? This debate shapes the Supreme Court decisions that are coming down in the next week or the next few weeks about the president's power to fire members of independent agencies, right? The war against the deep state. Mm-hmm. But it also is used, these line of cases are used for the president's ability to ignore congressional subpoenas for tax returns. And that's the big game. That's the big game is the Trump and the Federal Society and Barr have this bargain to keep pushing judges through that will create and solidify an imperial presidency, despite the fact that it contradicts all of the originalist methodology that we've been told is the bedrock principles of the originalist methodology.
Jed is a polymath, a historian and legal scholar, professor of law at Fordham. Thank you very much for being back here. It's such a pleasure to talk to you.
Thanks, Virginia. As always, great conversation.
That's it for today's show. What'd you think? Fill out your comment cards on Twitter. I'm at page 88. The show is at Real Trumpcast. And don't stop there. Subscribe to Slate Plus. Go to slate.com/Trumpcast Plus and sign up. Somebody just did the numbers for me. It's less than $3 a month for the first year. That's $35. And best of all, you'll be supporting our work, and you can feel good about that. So go to slate.com/Trumpcast Plus. Our show today was produced by Melissa Kaplan and engineered by Richard Stanislaw. I'm Virginia Heffernan. Thanks for listening to Trumpcast.
Okay, round two. Name something that's not boring.
A laundry? Ooh, a book club. Computer solitaire, huh?
Ah, oh, sorry. We were looking for Chumba Casino. That's right. Chumbacasino.com has over 100 casino-style games. Join today and play for free for your chance to redeem some serious prizes. Chumbacasino.com. No purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. 18+. Terms and conditions apply. See website for details.